welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. I'm Ailey Packham, and we are not going to the news, and we're going to stick with the football in association with OldFootballShirts.com. Well, it was very much a case of how to make friends and influence people last Saturday, in that Liverpool had a friend and we didn't. Despite losing, though, the fact that we were disappointed not to get anything against the free-scoring league leaders tells you just how far we've come. Today, we face another tough test with a trip to the resurgent Manchester United, who, since ditching the moaning Mourinho, have gone on a six-game unbeaten run. But can we do the double over them? Joining me today is, of course, Alan Wares, and we are delighted to welcome back the only man who nearly got sent off in a Renf game. That's Ali Jenkins, of course.
Two minutes, 38 seconds, Ali, before we mention that.
I was wondering.
And we also welcome a man who is no stranger to this parish, but is a raw virgin. But he did used to have a show on Reverb. And despite being from Manchester, when he's not propping up one of Brighton's new bars, he's often seen at the Amex supporting the Albion. Ladies and gents, it's Phil Jones.
Hi, guys.
Hello.
Great to be here.
Yeah, welcome,
great
one.
Stuff,
welcome
great
all.
Stuff. Absolutely. Ali, it feels like a while since you've been. We're saying this to all our guests. We've kept it too long since guests have been on. Can you recall? Because I haven't looked it up.
Well, actually, Ali was telling me before we came in.
Go on.
This is the fourth studio he's done a show in.
Well, that's probably about the same as us, then, isn't it?
I'm up there with the two of you.
Yeah, easily. It's a bit like Lewis Dunk playing under sort of so many different managers, isn't it? But anyway, welcome back, Ali. How are you?
Yes, very good, thank you.
Good one.
Well, I wasn't until I went outside to come in here today.
Anything particularly happening in your life since you were last on?
A couple of bits. Bought my first place, got engaged, watched the album a lot.
A belated congratulations.
Thank you very much. Yeah,
and moved back
ago.
To Brighton.
And moved back down to Brighton now.
Exiled
up north for a little bit.
Good to see you, mate.
Phil, welcome back to Reverb, firstly.
Good to be back.
You are from Manchester. But, mm-hmm. So rather than just telling us about your album supporting history, which of course you do actually have one, otherwise you wouldn't be here. But tell us about your football supporting history.
Well, I grew up supporting Man United. My dad took me to games when I was... This was 1964. I'm an aged person. I watched through the 60s. I saw Bobby Charlton, George Best. This mic's getting very close. Johnny Aston, who is probably not that well remembered. But then I went to university and I moved away from Manchester. And the 70s were not a great time to be following Man U, frankly.
No.
They nosedived. And I didn't have any friends who were football fans, so I must admit, I lost sight of football quite a bit. Then in the 80s, obviously, when Ferguson took over Man U, I started to pay more attention. But I stopped going to football on a regular basis until I moved to Brighton. And actually, somewhat poignantly, the first time I saw the Albion was at the Withdean. And the person with me was my nephew, who has now passed away. He was killed in a road accident at the age of 18. Mm. And he was that very rare thing, an American teenage football fan, as in soccer, not as in American football. Mm. And he was a Liverpool fan. And again, he was buried in his Liverpool shirt. Mm. That's Dowd. And those of us who know that I'm married to Mama Cherry, who is still cooking and has a YouTube channel, guys.
It is, actually. I followed one of her recipes I used this week.
Actually. Well, you can tell me more about that later. But Dowd, actually, my nephew, actually worked at the restaurant. He was here for a year. And if you came to the restaurant in about 2004 and you had a dessert, it was probably made by Dowd.
Fabulous. Now, that's an Albion supporting history, isn't it? I mean, you come from Manchester, you come down, you actually then sort of like see, you move yourself away from the dark side. And of all things you do in life, you marry sort of... Now, in trying to set up the studio earlier, we're having a bit of trouble with the volume control. Now, that is something you have on a daily basis, isn't it?
Yes, my wife is not... she doesn't have a volume control. And if you watch her YouTube channel, and honestly, I'm not saying this because I'm married to her, but it is hilarious. But she is the loudest person you're ever going to come across.
She is absolutely great. Really, and you know what? I like recipes that you can actually follow, and she makes it very, very easy to follow. And she does it in her own the amazing style.
Which, just... she only puts recipes down on paper because she has to. She just makes it up as she goes along. I mean, it's just extraordinary.
No, so it's getting back to the form. I mean, you know, we could actually talk sort of recipes all day. I mean, you know, AD and I, you know, we've done this before on air, and people say, "Hang on, you're a football show." Well, no, we'll yak about some recipe if we need to. So, if we ever have Mama Cherry on the show, yeah, then that'll
needs
be
more salt though.
Yeah, if we ever, if Sharita ever comes on the show, then you know, one, set your volume control as low as possible, AD. But two, you know, I think we'll come out of here. Look, well, you'll end up looking like me, you know, that big. But anyway, getting back to the football. So when you said you started watching football at the Albion, was it just because you were bored of missing live football, or was there sort of, you know, a hook that got you into the Albion at all?
Well, obviously, I'm aware of the history, and I remember hearing about the Goldstone, you know, sort of. Fracker, I'm not quite sure what the correct term is. I was a football fan again by that point, so I was well aware of what was going on. And, you know, it's a great story, you know, that Albion even survived, much less did as well as we're doing now.
We.
Did you know that? No, that was kind of conscious.
That's a sure sign that you're supporting a club when they become we.
Yeah. Well, exactly. I followed the sort of, you know, the trials of trying to get out of the championship. And actually one of the kind of, well, most frustrating games I've seen, apart from last Saturday, was 2 years ago, 3 years ago, when we missed the playoffs because we got beaten by Burnley. When Joey Barton, you know, yes, was sort of doing his Joey Barton thing. And that was just a travesty, that game. I mean, how we didn't win that one, I do not know.
Mm. I think we did draw that, though, didn't we?
We drew, but it wasn't enough, you know.
We drew it, and that was the one. It meant we had a bigger chance to finish in the playoffs. And that was the one where he stamped on Behram Kyle, yes, because Kyle hitherto had him in his pocket. Mm. And boy, did we rant about that on The Roar at the time.
I can well imagine.
Which stamp was that, the first, the second, or the third?
And which leg?
Quite, yeah.
First, second, or third? Sorry. Brilliant.
Okay, well, let's get on with to business then. That was, of course, the visit of the league leaders, which was, of course, Liverpool last Saturday. Team was very much as expected, with Glenn Murray spearheading the attack, and with Gaetan Bong in for the injured Bernardo. Basuma was also injured, and Max Sanders got a surprise call to the bench.
Yes. Sorry, was there a question? I'm sounding a bit like Eric Cantona now. Was there a question in there? Sorry,
there probably wasn't.
Okay, fine. I mean, yes, it was.
It's not much in sardines.
Yeah, but that was that. Then you get to realise that of the squad. I mean, what that actually showed us more than anything was of the squad that we have, central midfielders and what have you. That this is where we're at, and then after that's obviously Max Sanders is the leading central midfield player. To be able to step up and take his place. So we've talked about many times about the under 23 side and who's in there and who's going to be able to make that step up, and whether it's going to be a forward or defender. And a couple of defenders have made their step up, you know, they did for the League Cup. But for central midfielders, you get to realise that it's Max Sanders who's next in the pecking order.
Well, we all thought it was actually going to be James Tilley. Now, he's actually just gone out on loan to Cork City, which that was a bit of a surprise. I thought he would at least stay gone to a Championship or League One side.
Well, yeah, but you're getting back to wondering who is doing. I mean, there's a fair few loanees have gone out now. And it's always with a view to, okay, you know, taking your next step up. As to who is in what position and who is going to make the grade and who is, you know, that's, well, to be honest, you know, we need someone from the coaching side or from the academy to work, you know, tell us
which is in the pipeline,
which is in the pipeline now
in the future. But Ali, I mean, there's a lot said about Glenn Murray at the moment about whether he should actually be starting games now because of his obviously lack of mobility and with the emergence of Florin Andoni. I'd still like to see them together.
Yeah, I mean, it's Houghton's got a very set style of how he plays, whether that's good or bad. The versatility of his, you know, his formations is, you know, that's a different discussion. But you know, he seems to like that one up front. He's having the two wingers. What he seems to do is push them a bit closer together to the forward, I think, at the moment, which obviously doesn't help playing two up front. But it's sort of a bit more attacking and we're going a bit more for it. But I don't think he'll probably go two up front at all. I just don't think he likes doing that. And I don't think he Yeah, I don't think that's the way football is at the moment.
Well, whoever he's got playing just behind the central the central forward, is usually a supplier rather than an out-and-out forward. So this whole notion of sort of playing, as much as it would be delicious to have Murray and Andoni together, it's, I think, as you've exactly pointed out, it doesn't fit within Chris Hughton's way of playing.
Mm. But, I mean, you could argue. I mean, we're talking about...
Every time you say you could argue, what you're actually saying is that you're going against you're arguing against what Chris Hughton does knows.
I know you agree with this, because, I mean, as it stands at the moment, we've got, let's face it, a misfiring Pascal Gross, who he's probably only in the game for about 10%.
But Andoni is not that supplier.
But he has actually played that role in Spain. So has played as that number 10 behind the strikers.
Yeah, he's playing as a deep lying striker rather than a supplier. As much as we're talking about Gross is actually an advanced midfielder, more of an advanced midfielder than an out and out forward, or certainly than a deep lying forward. So, I mean, and he's tried Jack and Batch and March and Knockhart. All in that role, in that kind of rotating role where, you know, we've got effectively three wide players, but one will be at any given time behind the central person. But Andoni is not that kind of player. I know it sounds a bit dodgy saying this in Kemp Town. Andoni is a receiver, not a giver, if you see what I mean.
That sounds almost biblical.
Ali, say something.
Stunned silence.
I think what you're saying is right. Andoni is a striker who, to play that role, would need to be dropping deep, whereas Pascal was a central midfielder pushing further forward. Mm. But that means that it's more in his head and his makeup of his game to drop back and do the dirty work defending and be an extra a body and a number. And I don't think Andoni will do that as much because it's not his instincts to do it. Mm. Not because of any lack of ability.
That I notice is that. I presume, again, this is Chris Hughton's tactics. There's a lot of speed in the Albion team now, but he doesn't use it in midfield. He uses it on the wings. Mm. And you've got players like Izquierdo and Lacardia, who are quick, but they're only effective when they go wide. Solly March is another player, but he's one thing about him, I think, is he's an excellent defensive player as well.
We've been saying on this show for a while that we think he's going to be eventually going to become a wing back,
he'll be a wing back if ever Chris Hughton changes that. I mean, again, you're still talking about sort of Chris Hughton changing the entire makeup.
I didn't say here.
You said if he's a wing back, that means that is playing part of a back five slash back three.
I didn't necessarily mean here.
Well, what did you have in mind?
Well, you know, he could go somewhere else.
Well. I think March is one of these players that will do the exact instructions of what he's been told all week by the coaching staff to do, and that is why he gets in the squads and the starting 11 every single week. He might not be the flairiest player, we've got the quickest. He might sometimes be lacking a little bit of sort of football intelligence sort of when he gets in that final third. But Chris Hughton can tell him exactly where to be at the exact second of a game, and he'll do it. And Hughton likes the players that he trusts. And he likes the players that he knows will carry out his instruction.
I disagree to a certain degree with that because, I mean, we've seen him at times when he's just absolutely electric. And at times he's been unplayable. We've seen that player, but we just haven't seen that player for a couple of years now.
Well, I'm going to disagree with your disagreement. I think Ali is actually on the nail. There are times when March is maddening because I've had this criticism of Knockhart in the past as well. It's the choice in a given moment as to whether to play it short, play it long, look up and see the pass, or head down and try and get past the player, whatever it might be. Mm. It's a case of getting the right pass. I mean, we're back to Shankly again. If it's not the long ball or the short ball, it's the right ball. Mm. And like you say, I think that I think what you're saying here, Ali, is there's an air that March is a little bit of an automaton, a very high, high-powered, fast, talented automaton, but not one who, like you say, is going to be Flair, who's actually going to do something like Knockhart and try to entertain the crowd.
Was very noticeable on Saturday, I thought. I mean, when Knockhart came on, immediately he was running all over the place. I mean, literally running all over the place. And I was sort of thinking, well, you know, I mean, I know what he's like. I know he's like liable to do that. You're thinking, if he'd come on, I don't know, 10, 20 minutes earlier, would it actually have made a difference to the result? I don't know. I mean, I don't
He was very good when he came on.
He was, yeah, yeah.
Because but he's hungry at the moment. He's out. He's out of the side, and he wants to get back in the side now. How he's going to do that, I'm not quite sure. But I mean, a hungry anti knockout is a good anti.
It's okay, but also it can be a dangerous one as well. So, but getting back to the original point I'm making here, and I think it is something that's up for discussion. We've talked about it on here, and maybe I've sort of ploughed a bit of a lone furrow here, and being a bit sort of. Ahead of, a bit sort of knee-jerk on it. But I think it's now plain to see, I mean, this is the point that Phil was making just now, there is not a huge amount of mobility and speed of mobility. We know it from Murray, he's a bulldozer. But with Gross, it's noticeable. Whenever there was a couple of passes that were played 2 yards ahead of him, and it's like he'd got lead boots on running through treacle. And we need... that moment. And it's interesting that Phil, from a kind of more of a neutral standpoint, realizes that we have pace. Ooh. And because we've got more pace this year, Gross's relative lack of mobility is actually there for more people to see. I mean, I don't know what you guys think about that, but
well, you notice it with Montoya and Bernardo. I think the speed from the fullbacks. Mm. That's a big difference. I mean, not that Bruno isn't a terrific player, but yeah, he's 38 now. Yep. He's slowing up. It's inevitable.
He's as old as you, Phil.
Oh God, no, not quite that old. No.
But where do you think if assuming that because Gross's evident lack of mobility is so noticeable now, Ali. What do you think can be done short of dropping him? Because Chris clearly likes, him playing in the team. What can be done to actually sort of improve his worth within the side? Assuming that we're right and,
I think he probably would do a good job if he dropped a bit further deep and sat, maybe just sat in that quarterback role, spraying out passes.
But then, Dale Stevens and proper.
Exactly, the next point I was going to get to. Unfortunately for him, that is probably one of our most populated best positions on the pitch. Short of dropping one of the players who doesn't really deserve to be dropped, and there's a queue of people waiting to come in that also don't deserve to be key jumped.
For instance.
Yeah. Exactly.
So, we're saying all this stuff about Gross, but he did set up arguably our best chance of the game. And he also had the best chance, the second best chance of the game, but the best one, which would have put us 1-0 up, and we might have seen a very, very different game, which is when Lucardia pings a great crossfield ball to Pascal Gross, whose pinpoint cross finds Murray unmarked in the box, and he really should have hit the target.
For Glenn Murray headers, that was actually very, very poor, wasn't it? I mean,
bread and butter for him.
It's the kind of thing he thrives on. And let's put it this way. Jürgen Lacardia, a few weeks ago, had an opportunity against Burnley. Maybe more difficult, who knows. But the point is, as a header, that you felt he could have done a whole lot better for it. And he got so much dog's abuse for it. Now, admittedly, Murray is 102 goals down the line in his career. And I think that, is a lot more forgivable. But you also know that if that had been sort of, the Albion fans' boo boy who'd done that, the abuse would have carried on. It from Murray's point of view, that was poor.
It was very poor, but he's got enough in the bank to miss a couple of sitters, hasn't he? Let's face it. If anyone that deserves it.
As long as he could do it when we're 5-0 up.
Yeah. I mean, the annoying thing is, though, in a game when opportunities to score a goal are going to be few and far between, you've got to take your chances, and that's the difference between the top and the bottom sides in this league. And for at least make the keeper work from that position. I mean, he didn't get any power on it at all. It was just, it didn't even hit the target. But I was a bit disappointed by that. But
I think everyone was. Yeah.
I think it's also frustrating. I mean, Chris Hughton does seem to be. I mean, I remember when he was the Norwich manager, a similar situation, but he didn't have enough ideas to keep them up, but he's definitely matured as a manager, and I don't think he's as sentimental as maybe he was when he was managing Norwich. Who knows? I mean, Glenn Murray may not be playing as much as he has been, even though, obviously he's on target to become Albion's top ever, highest ever scorer. But Albion need to score more goals. I mean, winning, it's like 1-0 to the Arsenal versus 1-0 to the Albion now. That's been the scoreline for most of the victories this season. And there's enough good players in the team to score more goals. But I think that the Murray, you know, front man kind of setup is actually stopping us scoring more goals.
But I don't think we've seen our best team on the pitch this season.
Well, what is your best team?
That's just it. I don't actually know. But
but no, that could be tricky.
But the reason I say that is we've seen Bissouma dipping in and out. Yeah. Esquerdo's been injured for most of the season. Jahan Bash has been injured for most of the season. Lucardi has only just got having a run in the team in his preferred position, and we're seeing the benefits of putting a square peg in a square hole all of a sudden. And it's,
I think sometimes it depends on who we're playing as well. I mean, if you're playing Man City, what you don't have is the same kamikaze consideration that we have that, say, when we're playing, you know, with 10 men against Palace in the first half. You know, it's everything's sort of slightly different. So, I mean, and we had Lucardia up front against Manchester City and he hardly touched the ball, you know, so, and yet you know he's a decent player, but, you know, in the wrong position in that case.
But, I mean, Phil, you were talking about speed in the team. Mm. I mean, and you mentioned, like, you know, we know Esquerdo's a speed merchant. Mm. Jahan Bash is no slouch. You've got Bissouma, who's quick all over the park. Mm. You know, you've got those players who've not... I don't think they've all been in the team at the same time this season. Mm. And if they have been, they've been coming back from injury and not quite hit their straps yet. So, yeah. I mean, you know, I think that we are... It's Chris's job to blend those together.
Yeah, I think Chris Hughton, and this isn't a criticism, is by nature a defensive coach. But what that does mean is that Albion are really, really hard to score against. And I thought it was a terrific defensive performance against Liverpool. I really do.
Well, okay, well let's talk about that then, because there was a slight change in formation on this one where we had. That both our fullbacks were a little bit more inverted rather than hugging the touchline, which is what they tend to do. They were playing a lot closer to the centre backs.
Well, I think what they were doing was they were allowing, you know, sort of like the two wide players, who, you know, Terence Trent D'Arby and the fellow on the left hand side. They effectively said to them, right, you can own that so long as we.
Sorry,
they call him that as well.
Oh, do they? Well, yeah. I hadn't come across that.
So it actually sort of makes the centre ground a little bit safer. So, you know, we're leaving it to them. But yeah, I mean, you like, as Phil says, as Adie says, you know, we are very disciplined.
Ali,
yeah, we are. It's the old saying in football, isn't it? You know, you win titles by scoring loads of goals and having great forward play, but you stay up by having a solid defence and building from a good platform at the back. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're doing. And it worked really well last year because we finished mid-table and we look like we're on course for the same again. Okay. So, you know, can you knock it? You know, should we be really looking to do more
attacking? Only two teams have stopped Liverpool from scoring an open play this season. And that's us and Man City.
There you go.
Okay. Yeah, it wasn't for the want of trying though, but yeah.
Well, I mean, there was a couple of chances. I mean, I mean, the point
I was going to make about that was that, and taking on from Phil's point, yes, we are, sort of, you know, when it comes to, it's like when we play Palace, we're 3-0 up half time. You think, oh my god, we're 10-10, man, anything go wrong? And I'm thinking, we've managed to keep City from just scoring. You know, we kept them scoring twice. You know, Liverpool once. Crystal Palace won't have the nous to break down our defence if we are going to be, you know, want to do one of those disciplined defensive displays. Mm. I think the frustration is when we play have those defensive displays against teams that we know that we'd be much better off having a go at.
Yeah.
The weird thing is that when we played Liverpool, yes, the defensive you know, setup was very good and they were very disciplined for the most part. It's just the frustrating part for me was when we did get the ball, we looked utterly hopeless. You know, our ball retention once again was so poor.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
But I mean, Liverpool have got a player in Robertson who he's got to be the best fullback in the division at the moment, in my opinion. And he
ahead of Bernardo.
He can hear the drums
marginally, but.
I think Liverpool probably got the two best fullbacks in the league at the moment, to be fair.
But he didn't really get an awful lot of opportunity to shine. I mean, there was one cross which he swung in which just evaded Firmino. But I mean, Liverpool found it difficult to play against us. And we just needed that one opportunity, that Murray chance to go in. And I think we might have held on.
Yeah. I think, I don't know whether you're about to move on, AD, but I just want to say I was seriously impressed with Button. I thought he, you know, coming into the team, and when I heard, you know, realised Matty Ryan was going to be missing for the Asia Cup, I thought, oh God, you know, because he has really, you know, shone, I think, for Brighton.
A shining button.
Very good, yeah. I like your style. I like your style. But, you know, just complete confidence, commanded his area. Obviously, he was able to communicate with the rest of the defence, which is key when you're a goalkeeper. But no, I thought he did really well.
No, I don't really want to go into depth about about the referee's performance.
Really. Oh yes, we do. Oh yes, we do. Listen, mate, we can have three shows about this, mate. Do it with. Okay, where do we start? One. And it's, to be fair, Kevin Friend is not the first referee that's done this. There's so many that come across as starstruck. But then I was thinking about this. I think that we got the rub of the green when we were at the top of the championship. It just seems to be something that happens that if you're at the top, and let's face it, we spent 2 years at or near the top of the championship. Mm-hmm. And you realise that we're one of the better sides in the division. And we've done it by fouling less and scoring more and conceding fewer. So you get to realise there's a better team. And I can't help feeling that the referee would give you the benefit of the doubt. I just feel that the bar that we have when we foul a team is so much lower than when a team fouls us for us to get a free kick. And I feel that that's the case with... It sounds like a sort of like a sour grapes thing, but Ali, what, I don't know about you,
well,
but...
Well, actually, Ali, the stats are saying we're the dirtiest team in the league.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, stats will show you one thing, but you're also going to look at that we... Excuse me. We don't have as much of the ball as a lot of our opponents will. Because, mm-hmm. you know, you get the teams like the Liverpools, your Chelsea, your Man City, they will keep the ball and we will have it less. And from that very reason, we will be going searching for it more, and you commit more fouls. I don't know what it looks like, but I reckon if you looked at the fouling stats for the last 5 years, I reckon the teams at the bottom of the league will be higher up in that table compared to the teams at the top. I think it's just the way it is, isn't it? You know, we're trying to get the ball back of them, but do you feel
there's a fairness and a parity between the, not necessarily, you know, within the game or anything like that, but within games generally, but within a given game. That I don't notice that we have this issue when we're playing West Ham, we're playing Leicester, we're playing Watford, whatever it might be. But when we are playing one of the top six sides, let's say the severity of the foul has to be so much less for them to get a free kick than, or is that me being a grump?
No, I think it's, you know, obviously if anything goes against your own team, your first reaction is to turn around and think, oh, that's never, you know, ref's doing us over. But
I think it was noticeable on Saturday. I mean, the thing I noticed was. It's kind of. It wasn't just the sort of the obvious fouls, you know, or the kind of 50-50 balls. It's just almost every time there was the possibility of Albion committing a foul, he blew the whistle. And I was sitting there thinking, please don't let there be a sort of incident at the penalty area, because you know he's going to give a penalty. What happened? He did.
But I'm obviously still
trying to... be fair, that was a penalty, though. I mean...
I've seen them given. I've seen them given.
But I'm just still trying to work out how you can be off, nutmeg a player and be offside.
Remind us this, because you mentioned it earlier, and I'm trying to think of this situation. Give me a, for instance...
When Jürgen got through on goal, and he wasn't coming from an offside position... He put the ball through a defender's legs.
Oh, I think I know the
incident. And the flag.
No, the flag went up on the original from the original pass that he was ahead of the defender when the original pass. I couldn't tell you who it was. I'm going to say for the sake of his argument, it was Gross. It was a.
Well, they haven't shown it again, so maybe you're right. But I mean,
Let's put it so. It wasn't from, you know, him sort of taking the ball on.
Because there's no.
But I think you get to realise that most of the West Stand. Thought, and this is not as though the referee had been like this for the whole match, because it was fairly early on that most of the West Stand, I think, sort of strongly disagreed with the linesman, and I think he knew it very quickly, but did not care.
Tactfully put.
Okay, well, Button did actually get a hand to the penalty.
We can say that.
Well, yes, he did.
I mean, Salah did go down. Quite theatrically, but I mean, I can't argue against it.
He's got previous, let's face it.
Well, the thing is also, I mean, we'd be screaming for it because Gross did take a huge handful of shirt as well.
But there was some nice interplay between Montoya and March, which saw the Spaniard tee up Gross, and his snapshot was brilliantly blocked. That would have given us parity in the game. It was a lovely move, actually. And Gross was involved. It actually started the move.
Are you talking about the one that went across the air and his shot was blocked? And it's... It's one of those that where you'll see a forward and he'll sort of just let it. Well, number of goals that go in where it goes through defenders or the goalkeeper's legs. I mean, it's absolutely incredible. I mean, and it's one of those where he kind of lofted it almost. I mean, it came off the ground and hit him in the knackers. Whereas if it had stayed on the ground, well, at least it would have sort of had a chance of going in. But it was a good move, and indicative of the fact that actually we could play against them, and yet so often
left it too late.
It was not so much left it too late. We had a go during... The thing is, the consistency and the level of the play that we had... Don't forget the first. The first half was a wipeout. I mean, Liverpool didn't look like they were going to score. And, you know, we didn't either. And it was, for a neutral, it would have been a minger of a game. But when it came to the second half, I don't feel that we raised the gears that we could have done. And we're back to how far have we come that we're disappointed that we lost 1-0 to Liverpool.
Absolutely, yeah. That's what I said at the top
of
the show.
Last season was a different story, of course. Slightly.
I mean, just one other thing to talk about, which is Lacazette's shot from distance, which was a tip round the goal. It wasn't going in, but it was tip round the goal. But that was 70th minute, and that was our first corner of the game, which tells you that Liverpool were trying desperately not to concede any set pieces in and around the box, because that's how we score most of our goals.
Yes.
Okay, well, let's move on from that. And you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. We are delighted to be brought to you in association with OldFootballShirts.com, and I've got an absolute beauty this week. I'm just going to pass this over to Ali Jenkins here to describe for me.
So it's a white and red shirt, halved diagonally. I think it's pretty obvious what team it is from that description.
The fact that it actually says it on the badge.
Yeah.
I can't read that. Who's the shirt manufacturer?
I'm not going to say that because I don't want you guys to get thrown off the radio.
In this context, we can say it. Go on.
Okay, so it's Le Coq Sportif.
Yes.
Excuse the French.
Well, literally the sporting cock.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, you said it.
It's beautiful, isn't it?
It's absolutely
so,
very fine.
It's an old sort of long sleeve shirt, like as Ali said, sort of white shirt with the red diagonal on the top side, and the badge is
Monaco.
Monaco,
of course. Have you got a hazard guess at the year?
Well, I'm going to say 80s because. I haven't seen a Lacoste Sportif shirt for years. Anyway,
I think that might be the 90s.
Okay, I'm going to throw in 1987.
Not far off. And this is what Phil has to say this week. This is your shirt of the week, he says. It's the 1983-84 home shirt of French side AS Monaco, and it's a bit of a stunner. It's made by Le Coq Sportif and sponsored by Swiss luxury goods maker Bailey.
Bailey.
Yes,
isn't he the discredited
centre-back?
Isn't he the currently discredited Man U centre-back?
Yeah,
Bailey.
current Leicester City manager, the truculent. Well done, Phil. Claude Puel played for the Monégasque in this season. Yeah. They're currently coached by Thierry Henry and play in Ligue 1. And their home ground is the Stade Louis Dirt, which holds just over 18,000 fans. I thought it was bigger than that. It's not
a big place at all.
It just looks big because they get about five fans every week.
But it's famously on the top of a car park, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah, I've been past it. And there's not that much not much room in the Principality of Monaco. And, it's kind of, you know, they've got Carrefours everywhere, you know, the big supermarkets. And, yeah, I've not been to it, but I've been past it. Yeah. But
there's not really any real links with the album there. But there is a former youth player, a striker, called Brighton LeBeau, and that's his real name. and this season he moved to Amiens, and he's currently on loan at Villefranche Beaujolais FX. So thanks for that, Phil.
I'm impressed that your pronunciation's getting a bit better.
Well, French,
as German goes, it's not bad at all.
But as Romanian.
No, we're going to talk about some shirts again in a minute, but I just want to talk about something else first, which was there's been quite a lot all over social media in the last week or so, across Facebook and on Twitter, etc., about the 10 years ago and where there were pictures of themselves 10 years ago. And I mean, you posted something of 10 years after, which is quite good. But
as prog rock gags go, it was a brilliant one.
But I mean, I just wanted to have a look and see where the Albion were 10 years ago and how far we've come. And I thought, I was thinking to myself, well, you know, let's have a look at the team and go through the team and think, is there anyone in that team that would get into our current lineup? And then I thought, number 17, Glenn Murray.
Yeah. Right, hang on, before you do that in that case, let's see if our guests can rewind. So we're talking January 2009 here.
Yeah.
I can hear sort of like that. I can even smell the brains going here, thinking, you know, thinking hard.
Well, I actually saw the Albion's post on this the other day with the team on there, so I won't cheat and dive in and name them all.
But can anyone remember the Albion playing in, you know, in January 2009? So we're talking,
I remember the game very well.
So are we talking Russell Slade as manager? Or would that have been... Because I completely and utterly lose track.
It was Nicky Adams because... February that year was the game against Luton where we lost on penalties, where we would have got to Wembley, and that's when Mickey Adams went. So,
right, okay, so yes, so yeah, this time 10 years ago was Mickey. Right, got you. Okay,
so Adam Virgo was right wing, obviously for that.
Yes,
game.
It might have been in goal.
He was actually right back in this game.
Okay, that's
some sort of logic behind that.
Was Al Abd in the team at that point?
Adam El Abd, yeah. Yes, he was. Yeah. Yes, and he got a yellow card.
Oh, there you go. That's a surprise.
Well, don't forget, this is before Gus, and therefore was always liable to and prone to a mistake. So, no, I haven't actually seen this lineup. So.
It's quite shocking.
Go on then.
Gordon Greer?
No.
In goal, well, basically, first of all, it was the game against at home to Leeds where Glenn Murray famously got absolutely counters for
having a hernia,
for being as quick as he is now.
Yeah.
And the game that we lost 2-0, and actually Fabian Delph,
went herring away. Yeah,
he scored the second goal for Leeds in that game. Lee Trundle scored the first one, actually.
The referee.
Yeah. But our team was in goal number one, John Sullivan, Adam Virgo, Andy Wing.
Player of the season season, wasn't he?
The current Worthing manager, Adam Hinterwood. Adam El Abd, who's obviously currently at Wickham Wanderers. Tommy Elphick, who...
Where is he now?
He's back at Villa, isn't he?
I've lost track.
I don't know. He's at Hull, I think, last time I heard.
I think he's actually back at Villa now.
Or as you call him, Lewis Dunk.
Yeah. Long story. Also in midfield was the...
What's his name? Just tell him.
Totally forgotten Chris Birchall.
No, I hadn't forgotten. I mean, he was the Trinidad and Tobago one. So no, I hadn't forgotten.
He actually went to played in the same LA Galaxy team as Beckham, didn't he?
There you go. Yeah.
Then there was Tommy Fraser.
Yeah.
Kevin McLeod.
It's not exactly Stevenson proper, is it?
No. And then one player who if he was. Back then, if he was this age now, Nicky Forster.
Thurster.
I've gone the full Baron Absalom. Yeah. And Stuart Fleetwood.
Crikey! He wasn't the fellow we got from, was it Cheltenham or something?
Something like that. Yeah, I think Exeter maybe. Yeah. On the bench, Paul Crichton, the goalkeeper. Crikey.
Hang on, he was the coach, wasn't he?
He was the coach. Yeah. Yeah. And also Kerry Mayo, Dean Cocked, Doug Loft, and number 17, Glenn Murray.
That was before he started shaving.
Yeah, but just the Leeds team as well. Kasper Ankergren in goal. Bradley Johnson was playing for them. Another guy who played for us, Fabian Delph, Trundle, Luciano Becchio, who we tried to sign a while back as well. But that was in the
third division, wasn't it?
Yeah, but this is only 10 years ago. That's a blink of the eye in real terms.
Well, the thing is, if you'd have gone then from 2009 and done the same thing from 1999. Actually, there's probably a few that would have been still there, wouldn't there? So that's a kind of a moot point, really. Actually, in 99, well, we were at Gillingham.
Only Kerry.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, that's fair enough. Yeah, so yes, we have come a long way, but and let's face it, Murray hasn't stuck with us. It's kind of gone away and come back again. And I think his is far more an unusual story because, like I say, at 35, and how many people, even 10 years ago, even 2 or 3 years ago when he came back, said, right, he's going to carry on, he's going to tear up the Premier League, have probably his best time, you know, in his career, scoring goals in the Premier League. How many people would have said that? You know, this is the Duracell bunny that just keeps giving, in bulldozer form, admittedly. But this is the bunny that just keeps giving, Annie. I mean, you know, where do you stand on the whole thing of, right, he used to play for us brilliant, went to Palace, therefore he's dirt, and now he's come back and he's brilliant again? I mean, go on.
At the time, it was, what on earth are you doing? I'm paraphrasing, obviously. but it, you know, when he came back and he scored a couple against us at the Amex and didn't celebrate at all, I got a bit more respect for him. All right, he still.
And then he came back for Reading, scored a couple against us,
and doesn't celebrate. And then you know, obviously you start hearing the stories of why he left and what's surrounding it. It wasn't him wanting to just move. It was other issues in the background going on. And then he came back, and it was he'd been so long ago since the Palace that you forget about it.
I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, the story. I mean, it was $2,000 a week more. That's
we don't know exactly what the stories were. I mean, someone can say something, someone can say something else. We're not party to the discussions.
There wasn't an awful lot of difference between it, but basically, Gus just didn't want him.
It came down to the fact Poyet didn't fancy him for $2,000 a week. You'd have kept him, but Poyet just did not fancy him. For whatever reason, and he got rid of him, and that was it.
Absolutely. Well, he preferred Craig McHale Smith to play the Glenn Murray role, and he is, if anything, if you're going to have a similarity between whatever team, the current players we've got, he's more of an Andoni player. I mean, he was pretty quick, reasonable. He's certainly not of the same quality, but that would have been his role. So him alongside Glenn Murray would have actually been really, really good.
Yeah, but I really liked McHale Smith when he played for us. I just think it's unfortunate that he was playing in a team and formation and system that didn't suit him. He needed to play off, as you say, off a big man like Murray, and do the running and sort of feed off the scraps rather than being the target man who's going to stay in one place.
It's easy to say this in hindsight, but you realise that probably Ashley Barnes would have been a better target man, and he was the one that was more played out wide. And like I say, CMS was the... And when teams saw us actually playing pretty well, then they drop back 10 yards, and that then completely nullifies anything that CMS can do, because his trick is to actually go flying past the player who's been pushed forward. So, like I say, your big number... And let's face it, he is still a spiteful player. And when it was with us, brilliant. But when it's against us, you little asterisk. Ashley Barnes was that kind of, headbanger.
I mean, when he was playing for us, you wouldn't have thought he was going to go on and have the career that he's had at the top level, though. And he's been around he's been there for quite some time now.
Absolutely, but I think he would have done better than a lot of people realise. But to have been at a top division side for so long, I could see him doing reasonably well. That said, I still think he has done better than a lot of people would have said, but I don't think he wasn't cut out for the Premier League.
Yeah. I'm just looking at this team again here, and I didn't actually spot this originally, but there was 7 local lads in that team.
Well, that was the offload from Dean Wilkins' days, wasn't it?
But it was that was obviously we've just got Lewis Dunk now, and there was, I don't know if you've anyone seen it. There's a brilliant...
and Solly March. People forget that all the time, don't they?
Yeah. Eastbourne, though.
Isn't he from Eastbourne? Yeah. That doesn't count.
As was Dean Cox,
If Dean Cox wasn't from Eastbourne, Cookfield.
Well, yeah, but he spent a lot of time. Is it Eastbourne now?
Well, that's where he's playing.
Yeah, let's face it, we had Dean Hammond, and he's from Gloucestershire. So, Dan Harding was, he's from Gloucestershire, and he was part of that sort of kids' team. So,
Yeah, maybe. But it was. There was a brilliant. I don't know if anyone's seen it. There's a brilliant piece on Seagulls Player this week, which was. A Premier League TV thing with an interview with Lewis Dunk and his dad, and about his journey. And there's interviews with Hinch and stuff on there as well, which it's a brilliant story. And Stuart Tuck as well. It's a really, really lovely piece.
It's so, one of those things you have to pay for.
They'll probably make it free.
I'd hope so.
It's like, but yeah, it's. But it's
the Albion. Can I just say the Albion Roar is free. So Phil might appreciate and remember this from Radio Caroline. So is Loving Awareness. Okay. Loving Awareness is free.
But speaking of Phil and Phil Shelley, this is from oldfootballshirts.com.
What a link! You can tell he's been doing this a while. Seamless.
Now Phil has come in possession of a shirt this week, which is absolutely beautiful.
Wink, wink.
Yeah, it was sent to me from Amsterdam.
There you go.
But it was a beautiful one. It was one that the Albion never wore in a match. It was an old Adidas shirt from 1983, which had British Caledonian Airways emblazoned across it. It was only actually worn for a photo shoot. It was never actually worn.
Well, it was basically the Cup final shirt, but because obviously we changed our shirt for the Cup final. I tell you what, those I know people do like the plain blue shirts from the early 80s, But I hate it, especially the nipple burning ones. You know, those ones.
Well, it's no worse than the Buckter one.
No, they were knitted. They were heavy when they got wet.
The polyester one?
No, the Buckter one wasn't polyester. No, it was a knitted one. If you're talking about the 78, 79, I remember, Ryan, David Rose Sports got bought that for my ninth birthday. They either shrunk or grew in the wash. I can't remember which way round it was.
That's unusual.
Yeah.
So anyway, we got talking about what makes an iconic football shirt. What is the greatest football shirt of all time? Now, obviously, Phil Shelley, he's got the website. He's got over 96,000 shirts on there now, and there's a lot to choose from. So before we throw it open, and we'll have a discussion about what makes the best shirts. Now, for me personally.
I mean, we're talking about four sartorial legends in this room here who are able to discuss fashion in such a way here.
Is it fashion, though?
Is it fashion?
In a kind of way.
Well, I mean, there are shirts out there. They might not be your team or your country, but you look at them and think, oh, that's a thing of beauty. And for me, personally, the Adidas shirts from the 80s, like the French ones... The Brighton
French had Lecoq Sportif again. We're back to them. The Sporting Coq.
Those ones are great. And there's, of course, you've got the classic Italian teams, the Fiorentina shirt, the Sampdoria shirt. These are iconic shirts. I mean, what makes a shirt so?
I've no idea. Ali, over to you, mate. You go first.
I think trying to think back to some of the shirts when I was growing up that I really liked. I think it's actually simplicity is the best. When you have, you know, Brighton playing in blue and white stripes. You have Man United playing in red, you know, and you don't try and reinvent different colours and like, you know, Arsenal's last season at Highbury. I know it was a throwback to another shirt, but that's not Arsenal playing in that
burgundy
thing. That's not Arsenal. Arsenal are red with white sleeves. Mm. So, you know, keeping it simple. One of my favourite shirts growing up actually is the shirt that Arsenal had in '98 when they won the league and sort of Tony Adams bursting through. No, it's the Nike one in '98.
Oh right, yeah.
And so, you know, one of my big memories growing up as a kid was sort of, you know, that ball, Tony Adams against Everton last game of the season, win the league, scoring the goal. I remember watching that match today, and you know, it's one of the earliest memories I have, and that for that reason, that shirt is always quite an iconic one for me.
Yeah. Now, of course, Al, you used to have a shop selling retro football shirts.
Yeah, well, there weren't original ones, but the point is that, and actually, this is probably where I do need to bring in Phil, because, you know, Phil's pointed out that his first, you know, football games were back in the days of black and white. So,
for those of you with black and white TVs,
I'm wearing the red. Yes,
yeah, red. Yeah.
But the point is that if you're going back that far, we're talking about, you know, as Ali's just pointed out, let's say Manchester United in red, Liverpool in red, you know, Everton wore blue, and it was just sort of plainness, and they didn't even always have a badge, so it was as plain as plain could be. Yeah. So, you know, let's talk with you about sort of like, you know, your first memories of football shirts.
Well, actually, funnily enough, it was verbal rather than visual, because I used to buy, was it the News of the World and Football News annual, and you'd have, you know, sort of a page on every team, and it would describe their kit. And this was obviously, well, we did have TV, just about, but, you know, you didn't get to see these.
Because you have to hold
shirts.
A coat hanger above your head.
Sometimes, yeah, but we won't go into that. But to cut to the chase, the one I always liked, first of all, because I thought, oh, this sounds really good, was the original Wolves kit, which they haven't changed much from, which was old gold with black piping and black shorts. And, you know, just the words old gold, I thought, wow, that sounds interesting. Yeah. And there was a richness to the gold, which I don't think they've got anymore. I think Watford did at one time have a you know, gold shirt that looked quite similar. But that would probably be the one for me. And I agree with Ali. I think simplicity is, you know, you can think about, you know, orange and black stripes and think, oh, that's quite sort of exciting. But no, it's got to be simple.
So, I mean, when you think of like the Dutch shirt from the when they won the European Championship, was it 86?
Yeah, I hated those ones with all those sort of you know, watermark patterns and whatever. I just hated them. They're not simple at all. You know, if you're going to think of an iconic Netherlands shirt, then you think back to 74, and the story goes that they were Adidas and Johan Cruyff refused to wear one with three stripes because he was sponsored by someone else for his shirt, and he had two stripes down the sleeve. You know, and that kind of ridiculousness. But the thing is, you also associate a really good, clear, clean, iconic shirt. Sorry, go on, carry on.
For rubbish Joe, total football but partial shirt. Boom, boom.
Thank you very much for that.
Cruyff.
Yeah, no, I know. I know.
You can edit it.
If you want a really bad Dutch joke, you're gonna get a bad rep for that.
All right. We're gonna turn away from that.
Sorry, but you've got.
Yeah.
Right. No, you associate the most iconic shirts with success as well. Mm. I mean, when you think of the Brazil side of 1970, the Netherlands side of the 74. Even the Argentina side of 78, you know, these are the until the early times of the 19, certainly in this country of 1980s, by which time advertisements on the shirt started sneaking. And nowadays we've got one on the sleeve, we've got a secondary one, we've got one on the back, you know, and you see ones with the number of times that Phil has given us a shirt and it's got, you know, 6-7 advertisements on it. It's more like a racing driver's shirt.
Or the ones from the Belgian leagues as well.
Absolutely, it's slightly ludicrous. So,
I mean, some of my favourite ones, though, are the 70s French ones with the giant adverts on it. The Saint Etienne one was absolutely brilliant.
Saint Etienne, and even the fledgling Paris Saint-Germain had this huge RTL across them. You know, yes, this is what I'm saying about the English shirts, because with the French shirts, and I think possibly even a couple of German ones, they had advertising on their shirts before we did in England. And I think Bryant was one of the first ones to have it. I remember Liverpool had Hitachi for a long time, and British Caledonian came along not long afterwards. But again, I think
And who did Everton have?
They had Hafnir for a long time.
Hafnir, yeah.
But they had, I think they had someone before that even. But the point I'm making is, I think all of us agree in here, is that a football shirt is a uniform, and it represents the club, and therefore the simplicity, you know, the fact that we are blue and white stripes, the fact that, you know, believe in Crystal Palace have actually done something completely different. In the 1970s, they were a claret and blue side, like West Ham, like Burnley, like Scunthorpe, and they had it changed artificially to the red and blue that they are now. That for me is actually sort of changing and rewriting history, and not, you know, so it's another thing to pick on Crystal Palace for, but when we have our blue and white stripes, and then we had the Argentina one, which was horrible, and we had, you know, let's put it this way, the season we won the third division, blue stripes with sort of fairly blue shirts with fairly narrow white pinstripes, people quite like it, but I only say they like it because it's alongside with success.
Like,
let's put it this way, if we're successful with that Argentina shirt, people might like it. Go on, sorry, Ali.
So I was just going to say, yeah, as much as I said I like a simple shirt, your point about the Poyet title winning shirt, it's true. It is. I like that shirt. It is one of my favourite Brighton shirts. But I think it's any Brighton shirt with more blue than white. This year's effort, it's not the best, I don't think, because it's more white than blue. But I think if it's more blue than white, well, I think that's okay. Acceptable and quite a good shirt.
Okay. So what we want you to do is basically go on to oldfootballshirts.com.
Just the 96,000 to go through.
Just 96,000 to go through. And like, just tweet us what you think is the greatest football shirt of all time, and then we'll come back and have a look at it. We'll do a poll later on in the season.
Okay, well, you've clearly been thinking about it, but, you know, we can discuss it, and I'm sure you've changed your mind. It's a bit like being asked your favourite song, because it will change day on day.
Yeah, yeah.
Right now, in your mindset, can you come up with two or three, or even one favourite shirt that that cannot be beaten?
Well, it can be beaten, obviously. But I mean, I like I said, I like the Adidas ones from the
who's Adidas ones? Sorry,
like the French white away kit was absolutely beautiful they had the one with the solid blue collar,
yes,
with the V on it, and then they had the one with similar to
it was around it was like a polo t-shirt, yeah, almost,
and
wasn't
then,
it? Yeah.
Then they had the one with the lines across it as well, which was, it was just classic, like simplicity, and you know, I guess you associated with greatness, because it was the shirt that Michel Platini was wearing, who was the greatest player in the world at the time,
probably, yeah. And yet you consider, you know, sort of the nature of simplicity. One of the most favourite football shirts of England fans is the one from the late 70s, early 80s with the red and blue going across the chest. And you think, well, that's not a, you know, what's going on there? It doesn't represent the flag. It doesn't necessarily represent the country, whatever it is. And yet it's still one of the favourites. So whilst it's simplicity, it can also be iconic, yeah. But and also I think associated with success. Do let us know on social media, yeah. What is your favourite shirt and why?
And we'll put up reminders and stuff just to do that. But okay, well, today we go to Manchester to play your old side, Phil.
And, I guess so, yeah.
So, and they have definitely turned a corner of late. Mona Mourinho has gone.
He has.
And what a difference that has made.
Yeah, and what is interesting to me, and Ali and I were talking about this before we started. You know, before we started the show, I actually think, and it is starting to get mentioned, but for me, the key appointment isn't Solskjaer, it's Phelan. because when David Moyes was appointed, I mean, I was one of the people who thought, yeah, but, you know, I always root for the underdog, and Moyes always came across as an underdog, and in fact, he performed like an underdog.
Well, he's still under contract. He could come back if you want.
Well, we'll find out about that soon enough. But he made a mistake. Well, a lot of managers do this. Some of them, for some of them it works, but it certainly didn't work for him. He bought his own team in, and he got rid of the existing team, and Mike Phelan is a terrific coach. And I think, although I'm pleased to see Solskjaer doing well, and I think he may get the job long term. I'm not sure he will, but I think the key difference is Phelan. I really do.
Okay, now.
What does that mean? He's done then. What are Manchester United doing? I mean, obviously winning, but what are they doing now that they weren't previously?
Well, you mean under Mourinho?
Yeah.
Well, at the risk of stating the obvious, they're enjoying themselves, and they're obviously being given the freedom within obvious limitations. I mean, no manager's going to say, you know, just go out and enjoy yourselves, unless they're Harry Redknapp, I don't know. it's obvious that there's a structure, but there's flexibility. And the most exciting teams under Fergie were the ones where, you know, you never quite knew where the players were going to be. You know, they were swap. You know, this was the, you know, the Beckham era, you know, when players would be switching wings. I mean, that's now quite fashionable, but at the time it was actually quite radical. And I think all Solskjaer has done, he's taken the reins off, said, express yourself, play within, you know, certain rules.
He's given them a cuddle.
You can say that.
But so, Ali, so moving forward from the games that we've had this year, now we lost twice up there last season. But I think we were buoyed by the fact that we gave a good account of ourselves, and in so doing, won down here at the Amex twice. Looking ahead to today's game, are you more fearful of how Manchester United are going to turn up and play against the Albion than you would have been sort of like the past three or four games?
Yeah, I think, you know, you look at the difference in the two sides, and I think you'd always fancy yourself against Man United pre-Christmas in Mourinho, as we've seen, you know, beating them already this season quite comfortably. But, you know, they've won six on the bounce, whatever it is. It's going to end at some
Let's
point.
Let's face it, though, they were very, very lucky. I mean, Spurs hit a wall in De Gea last week, which was just, I mean... games like that, I mean, the fact he was in the right place at the right time that amount of times...
Yeah.
I mean, if De Gea doesn't have the game of his season, and if Harry Kane actually works out to put the ball in the net, for, you know, then United don't win the game. You know, they could have easily, and they, under Mourinho, they probably would have done, lost that 4-5-1 maybe. Mm. You know, it's going to be tough. It's Man United at Old Trafford. It will be tough no matter who's the manager, who the team is. You know, no matter who's going there. Some of the best teams in the country go there and will go there this season, and they won't get a result.
Can we upset the odds though?
I think there's every chance.
I think one of the reasons to be hopeful as an Albion fan tomorrow is that Man U have won six games. You know, everything's going well, and we all know that when teams, you know, sort of feel they're doing well, that's when they get complacent.
And Solskjaer's done his team talk for us already this week by teams like Brighton #.
Well, you could say that.
What was the context though? Did he say we should be beating them?
Basically,
it was something on the lines of "It's the Tottenham game isn't a measure of how good we are; it's how we dominate teams like this weekend.
How we dominate teams that we're better at, and who we're going to dominate."
Yeah,
he's a dead man walking.
Yeah, so that's Chris's team talk on the wall. But that is pretty much all we've got time for. Just quickly before we do go out, we have got an announcement.
Yes, we're just a reminder that we have the Robert Eaton Memorial Fun Quiz on the Friday the 15th of March in the Mayo Wynn Baxter Lounge at the Amex. That's the big one with the wavy ceiling. We've outgrown the Heineken Lounge, so if you can help prove that, do come along. Book your teams of up to six. It's a fiver ahead. I will probably drive you around the twist that evening, but then I do that every time you listen to the Albion Raw. And if you want to book a team, or if you want more information, do email me alan.wares@ntlworld.com. So that's Friday the 15th of March for the 9th annual Robert Eaton Memorial Fun Quiz. Be lovely to see you there.
So that's it. That's been this week's Albion Raw. So all that's left to say is thank you to Ali Jenkins, thank you to Phil Jones, thank you to Alan Wares. I've been AD Pack, and we're going to be back next week. We'll see you then. Thanks for listening. Bye.
What would you do if I sang out of tune? Would you stand up and walk out on me? Lend me your ears and I'll sing you a song. I will try not to sing out of key. Yeah. Oh, baby, how do you do? All I need is my brother. I say I'm gonna get high. Tell you, don't even say it no more. Gonna get out of my friend. All the time, yeah.
What do you see when you turn out the light?
I can't tell you, but it sure feels like mine. Don't you know I'm gonna make it with my friends? I promised myself I'd get by. Said I'm gonna try it with a true heart. I'm gonna get on back. I'm gonna take them all.